A Contra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge, Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Contra AI. Welcome to the deep dive. Today we are opening up a book that honestly, it reads like some kind of wild thriller movie, but it's all terrifyingly real.
Mm-hmm.
We're diving into Billion Dollar Whale, Joho Lo's Kleptocracy by Tom Wright and Bradley Hope.
Yeah, and this is, well, it's pretty much seen as the definitive story of the 1MDB scandal.
Right.
We're talking about the systematic theft, the looting, really, of somewhere between $4.5 and $5 billion from Malaysia's sovereign wealth fund.
Billion with a B.
Exactly. It's this huge story of global corruption that pulls in politicians, big-name celebrities, even some of the world's largest banks.
And maybe the craziest part, right off the top. The main guy, this Joho Lo, he actually used some of the stolen money to help finance the movie The Wolf of Wall Street.
I know, it's almost unbelievable.
A film literally about financial fraud and living hard. The sheer nerve of it is just, wow. And that audacity, that hubris, is really central to what this book explores.
It really is. And you know, this isn't just a story about some complicated investment that went bad or something.
Right.
It's more like a guidebook, unfortunately, on how modern kleptocracy that's ruled by thieves, how it actually works today.
Right.
The authors lay out exactly how political power and, well, the global financial system kind of mesh together to let a crime this massive happen. It's definitely a sobering read, but really essential if you want to grasp some of the dangers in modern finance.
Okay, so to really get how they piece this incredible story together, we should probably talk about the authors, Tom Wright and Bradley Hope.
Definitely.
Because they weren't just like reporting on it after the fact. They were right in the middle of it.
That's exactly right. So Tom Wright was the Asia economics editor for the Wall Street Journal, and Bradley Hope was a finance reporter based in London for the journal too. And these guys, they didn't just cover financial crime. They were the actual investigative journalists who broke the 1MDB story wide open for the world, starting back in 2015.
So their viewpoint isn't academic or theoretical. It's like from the trenches.
Totally. They were literally tracking the money in real time as it moved across different countries, different continents.
Mm-hmm.
Their access was, well, kind of unique. It came from years of being on the ground, reporting, and crucially, they got access to these key leaked documents.
Ah, the whistleblower leaks.
Yes, from Xavier Giusto. That was huge. So they show us how the whole thing unfolded step by step. It gives the book this really gripping, you know, inside the investigation feel, something you just wouldn't get from an analysis written later. They were really central to the whole public unraveling of the crime they ended up documenting.
Okay, so let's get into the book's core idea. You've got this one guy, Joho Lo, no official government job, nothing like that.
Right.
And yet, he becomes the mastermind behind arguably one of the biggest financial heists ever.
Yeah.
How on earth did he manage that? How did he get around all the usual checks and balances?
Well, the book makes a really strong case that Lo's true talent wasn't really in finance itself. It was more psychological.
Mm.
It was this incredible manipulation of perception. He basically built an image, a reputation, that was way bigger than his actual standing.
Okay.
He seemed to figure out early on that if you just look incredibly wealthy and connected, people just assume you are. They assume you have the money and the power to back it up.
So less finance guru, more social engineer.
Exactly. He was a master social engineer. He transformed himself from, you know, a well-off but not super elite student into this figure who seemed to be at the center of global finance and power.
And that image, that facade, was enough to get him access to Malaysia's 1MDB fund. Maybe we should clarify, what exactly is a sovereign wealth fund like 1MDB?
Good point. So simply put, a sovereign wealth fund is basically a state-owned investment pot. Countries use them to invest their surplus money, like from oil revenues or reserves for the long haul, theoretically for the benefit of the country and its people.
Theoretically.
Right. The book argues pretty convincingly that 1MDB, which was set up under Prime Minister Najib Razak, was maybe less about national benefit and more like a state-sponsored slush fund.
A piggy bank for political influence.
Pretty much, yeah. And Joho Lo effectively got the keys to it.
Okay, so he has the keys. But how does he get the money out without anyone noticing billions are disappearing?
That's where
this complex web comes in, right?
That's it. He created this incredibly complicated network of dozens and dozens of shell companies.
Meaning companies that just exist on paper.
Exactly. They don't really do anything, often registered in places with high financial secrecy, like the British Virgin Islands or the Cayman Islands. Low used these fake companies plus completely bogus investment schemes to just systematically vacuum billions out of 1MDB.
And where did the vacuum money go?
It vanished into, well, luxury real estate all over the world, incredibly expensive art, private jets, super yachts, and of course, this unbelievably over-the-top lifestyle we need to talk more about.
Right. Let's trace that back a bit. You said he wasn't from, like, mega wealth originally.
Mm-hmm.
Where did he pick up this skill of projecting wealth he didn't initially have?
He learned it pretty early, apparently. He went to some very elite schools, Harrow in the UK, then Wharton Business School in the US.
Okay, top tier.
Yeah. And the book describes how even back in college, he'd do things like rent fancy cars and plush apartments just for show to make himself seem like this big shot already.
Wow, starting early.
Totally. And he used that manufactured image to network really effectively. And the key connection he made was with Riza Aziz.
And Riza's was.
He happened to be the stepson of Najib Razak, who was about to become and then became Malaysia's prime minister. That relationship was absolutely critical. It was Low's in.
So that connection is the key that unlocks the door to 1MDB. The fund gets set up, pitched as this great national development project.
Right.
But the book says the looting started almost immediately, and it wasn't subtle. Tell us about that first big fraudulent deal.
It's honestly staggering. The very first major transaction was supposed to be a joint venture, a $1 billion deal between 1MDB and this little-known Saudi oil company, PetroSaudi.
Okay, sounds legitimate enough on the surface.
Right, but the authors uncovered that out of that first $1 billion, over $700 million was instantly diverted.
Instantly.
Instantly. Not into the joint project, no. It went straight into a Swiss bank account controlled by a shell company owned by Johol Low.
$700 million, just like that.
Gone. Poof. So this wasn't some slow leak or mismanagement. It was a massive planned heist from day one, hidden behind the mask of a legitimate international partnership.
And a theft that huge, involving state funds?
Hey.
You'd think the banks involved would raise alarms? This brings us to the role of big financial institutions, doesn't it? Particularly Goldman Sachs.
Yeah, Goldman Sachs plays a really central and frankly pretty damaging role in this story. They were apparently very keen to get a bigger foothold in Southeast Asia's financial markets.
Yeah.
And they ended up underwriting a series of bond deals for 1MDB, totaling around $6.5 billion.
That's a lot of money.
It is. But what really raises eyebrows and what the book hammers home are the fees Goldman charged. They earned something like $600 million in fees for these deals.
$600 million.
Just in fees.
Yeah, which is, I mean, way, way above the normal industry rate for that kind of work. Hugely inflated.
So the book suggests this wasn't just good business for them. It was suspiciously lucrative. Almost too good to be true.
That's exactly the implication. The book argues it points to willful blindness.
Willful blindness. Meaning they chose not to see.
Pretty much. The argument is that the bankers involved, led by a key figure named Tim Leissner, saw the dollar signs, they saw the prestige of working with a sovereign wealth fund, and they basically ignored or explained away a whole bunch of massive red flags.
Red flags suggesting money laundering or corruption.
Yes, things that should have stopped the deals in their tracks. But the potential profits were just too huge. Low really exploited that assumption of legitimacy that comes with a government fund. It proved a quote from the book. In the world of sovereign wealth funds, size mattered more than scrutiny.
So the money's flowing. The banks are looking the other way.
Or at least not looking too closely.
Right. And this torrent of stolen cash fuels this absolutely mind-blowing spending spree.
Mm.
The book almost reads like an inventory of extreme luxury.
It really does. And it kind of speaks to Low's whole method, right? He needed to constantly perform success, project this image of being incredibly wealthy and influential to keep the whole scam going.
So the spending wasn't just for fun, it was part of the strategy.
Partly, yeah. We're talking over $250 million just on parties.
Yeah.
These weren't small get-togethers. These were legendary bashes in places like Vegas, St. Tropez with A-list celebrities.
What?
He bought famous multi-million-dollar paintings by Monet, by Basquiat. He bought the super yacht Equanimity for $250 million. Private jets, mansions.
And he was using this stolen government money to basically buy access and legitimacy, wasn't he? Gifting millions in diamonds to Miranda Kerr, showering Leonardo DiCaprio with gifts.
Exactly. It was all about embedding himself in that world of celebrity and finance, making himself seem like he belonged there, like he was a legitimate player.
Which brings us back to the Wolf of Wall Street. financing it through Riza Aziz's company, Red Granite Pictures.
That was really the peak of the audacity, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Using money stolen through fraud to fund a blockbuster movie about fraud and then showing up on the red carpet with the stars. It was this bizarre meta way of laundering his reputation in public view.
But living that large, that publicly, eventually that draws attention, doesn't it? How did this whole house of cards start to wobble and fall?
Well, the unraveling really started in large part thanks to the journalists who wrote this book, Right and Hope.
They're reporting in the Wall Street Journal.
Exactly. Fueled by those leaked documents we mentioned, they started publishing stories that laid out the money trail, piece by piece.
And that must have caused chaos back in Malaysia.
Oh, absolutely. It became a massive political scandal. And importantly, their reporting also triggered serious investigations by law enforcement agencies around the world. The U.S. Department of Justice, in particular, really took notice.
Right. The DOJ launched that huge asset forfeiture case, didn't they? Trying to get back the stolen goods.
They did. It was, at the time, the largest kleptocracy asset forfeiture action they'd ever undertaken. They aimed to seize over $1 billion worth of assets bought with 1MDB money.
Including the rights to The Wolf of Wall Street.
Yep, the rights to the movie itself, plus things like the paintings, the real estate, and eventually they seized the superyacht Equanimity.
Wow.
And this coordinated international effort involving the U.S., Singapore, Switzerland, and others put immense pressure on the Malaysian government. It was a major factor in Prime Minister Najib Razak losing the election in 2018.
And he faced prosecution afterwards.
He did. He was eventually convicted on corruption charges related to 1MDB. Joe Alo, however,
he vanished.
He became and remains an international fugitive. Which, you know, kind of highlights how difficult it is to achieve full justice in these massive global corruption cases.
That whole narrative really underscores some big themes the book drives home. The first one feels like the globalization of corruption.
Absolutely. 1MDB wasn't just a Malaysian problem. It was a truly global crime. It showed how easily corruption can cross borders now.
Lowe exploited something called regulatory arbitrage, right? What exactly does that mean in practice?
Yeah, regulatory arbitrage. It basically means shopping around for the countries with the weakest rules or the least enforcement.
Oh, okay.
Lowe moved the stolen billions seamlessly through banks and shell companies in places like the British Virgin Islands, Switzerland, Singapore, the U.S. He used the complex web of different national regulations to hide the money's origins.
So the very system built for global business also makes global crime easier.
That's the paradox, yeah. The interconnectedness that drives the global economy also creates vulnerabilities that criminals like Lowe can exploit brilliantly.
Okay, the second big theme seems to be the psychology of elite capture. This wasn't just straightforward bribery, was it?
No, it was much more subtle, more seductive, you could say. Lowe seemed to understand instinctively that powerful, high-status people are drawn to glamour, exclusivity, the feeling of being an insider.
Right.
So he didn't just offer cash bribes, necessarily. He offered access to this incredible lifestyle, the private jets, the crazy parties, hanging out with celebrities. It was about compromising people's judgment by making them feel special, making them want to be part of his world.
That willful blindness again.
Yeah.
They didn't want the party to stop.
Exactly. It's a kind of seduction rather than just a transaction.
And the third theme, which feels really crucial given who wrote the book, is the indispensable role of investigative journalism.
Yeah, this story is almost exhibit A for why a free and tenacious press matters.
Oh, so?
Well, think about it. The political system in Malaysia was compromised. The global banks failed in their gatekeeping role. Regulators were slow or ineffective. In that situation, who was left to expose what was really going on?
The journalists.
Right. It was the painstaking, often dangerous work of investigative reporters like Wright and Hope that brought the facts to light and forced accountability. It shows that when official checks and balances fail, journalism is often the last line of defense.
The book itself is full of these really sharp observations that just cut to the heart of the matter.
It really is. They have a way of summing things up powerfully. Like, focusing on the banks, there's that line, "The bankers saw dollar signs, not red flags."
Oof. Yeah, that perfectly captures that profit over prudence mentality, doesn't it?
It really does. But and then there's the insight into Lowe's core strategy. Lowe understood that in the modern world, perception was often more powerful than reality.
That's his whole playbook in one sentence.
Yeah.
He built his entire empire on an image.
Completely fabricated. And another key one explaining how he got away with it using the state fund. In the world of sovereign wealth funds, size mattered more than scrutiny.
Right. The sheer scale and official nature of 1MDB gave it a respectability that allowed Lowe to bypass the checks that maybe a smaller private deal would have faced.
Exactly. The assumption was, it's a government fund, it must be legit. He exploited that trust.
Okay, so taking all this in, this incredible story of fraud and systemic failure, how does it apply to us? What are the takeaways for, say, someone listening who works in finance or just wants to be a more informed citizen?
Well, for anyone in finance or really any business dealing with large sums or complex international deals, 1MDB is like the ultimate cautionary tale in due diligence failure.
So learn to spot the red flags.
Definitely. The practical lesson is about skepticism. If a deal seems too good to be true, if the fee structure is way out of line with norms, if the transaction setup is overly complicated for no clear reason.
Or if someone's trying to rush you.
Huge red flag. Criminals love to use time pressure and that fear of missing out to get people and institutions to cut corners on checking things properly. And be wary of individuals projecting massive wealth without any clear, verifiable source for it.
And what about for us just as citizens or for policymakers? What's the bigger lesson there?
I think the big lesson is understanding that this kind of kleptocracy isn't just a problem over there. It operates as a global system.
How do you mean?
The book shows clearly how money stolen from a country like Malaysia can be laundered through Western financial centers and then even used to buy influence, real estate, or access in countries like the U.S.
So corruption abroad can actually impact our own systems.
Absolutely. Stolen funds can be weaponized politically or economically elsewhere. It underlines why things like transparency in campaign finance and much stronger international rules to figure out who really owns those anonymous shell companies are so vital.
Because these global loopholes affect everyone's stability in the end.
Precisely. So as we kind of wrap up our thoughts on Billion Dollar Whale, for me, the single biggest thing that sticks is just how fragile the global financial system seems. That interconnectedness we rely on for trade and growth, it's also its biggest weakness when it comes to this kind of sophisticated crime.
Yeah, what stands out to me is that J-Ho Lowe, as brilliant and audacious as he was, couldn't have done it alone.
No way.
It took this whole ecosystem, didn't it?
Yeah.
Lawyers, accountants, bankers.
Yeah.
People who either actively helped or practiced that willful blindness because it was profitable.
Right.
And preventing the next 1MDB, it feels like it requires changing the incentives for those professional gatekeepers, making it much riskier or less profitable to look the other way.
I completely agree. The financial world really needs to internalize that lesson. Their global reach is both a huge asset and a massive vulnerability if they don't take their gatekeeping role seriously.
And just on a purely human, almost unbelievable level, financing the Wolf of Wall Street with stolen money.
It's still just wow.
The sheer mind-bending hubris of it all. Unforgettable. It felt like an act of supreme confidence that, ironically, probably helped bring the whole thing crashing down in the end. Hollywood couldn't make it up.
Couldn't have written it better.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.